Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Megan Cochran. Today, I welcome Alexei Lokmatov to discuss his new book, Public Knowledge in Cold War Poland, Scholarly Battles and the Clash of Virtues, 1945 to 1956. Alexei is a Walter Benjamin Research Fellow at the University of Erfurt. He earned his PhD at the University of Cologne and the Tadeusz Mantufel Institute of History at the Polish Academy of Sciences. His research is in the history of science and humanities, public knowledge, and intelligence research. Alexei Lokmatov, it is a pleasure to welcome you to the New Books Network. Let's start with you. Please tell our listeners about your background and why you decided to write this book now.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here and to speak to you. Regarding your question, I think that is a kind of constellation of coincidence and some more or less intelligible developments. It's in a good play. There were various motives that were developing independently from each other, but were brought together in this book. And I think that the first and the most obvious aspect of this is the region. And I think that from today's perspective, the question why I decided to write, to deal with Polish history has a more or less simple explanation. My history teacher at school was an expert in Polish history. And already as a school boy, I was aware of the history of Poland and probably most important with a national Polish national view of history, which was very different from other national views of the historical events and processes of the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. And I think that the question why people see and interpret the same things differently is a kind of starting point of every scholarship. I was always striving to overcome all kinds of national visions of the reality, but that is exactly why the Polish case provided me with very rich material for reflections on these questions. As a history student, I focused on the 19th century and on the struggle between, let's say, the agents of Russian and Polish influences in the territories of today's Belarus and Ukraine. But already my bachelor thesis was devoted to the so-called Sovietization of Poland after the Second World War. And that is a bridge to the second field of my interests, the issue of how authoritarian regimes establish themselves and legitimize themselves, mobilize people, masses, struggle against the tendencies and the social group that they consider danger for their stability. And of course, I was also interested in the question how to struggle, to resist to the spread of the authoritarian regimes and what methods of destabilizing this system were used. The third field of interest, which I think is extremely important for writing this book, is the history of science and scholarship. I'm working in the German context. We are using the concept Wissenschaftsgeschichte. It's a kind of science and scholarship, the concept that strive to overcome, or to be more precise, didn't follow this relatively new separation between sciences and humanities, which we know from today's English. And the questions that were extremely important, were interesting to me, were how various historical conditions, ideas, or stereotypes, or political theories, or ideologies were reflected in the scholarly and scientific practices, and how scientists and scholars try to use their academic and professional background for developing social theories or political theories. And I was interested in this not only at this superficial level, like we all know politics, science, or and so on, but at the level of epistemology, in a sense, how this mutual influences created, so to say, condition which certain ideas, certain forms of knowledge could appear. And I'm afraid that in the recent years, when I was finishing this book, all these groups of fashions got just more relevance, unfortunately, because the rising of nationalism or the expansionism of the authoritarian regimes and the questions of resistance, intellectual resistance to them, also authoritarian tendencies in our societies, for example, all these make these issues much more relevant that I wish them to be, to be honest. But I don't think that this book would provide the reader with the answers to all these questions, but I do think that it could give some material for reflections on them.
Yes, and it's a really interesting view. In the book, you present the idea of what you call virtues, and I do that with the air quotes, virtues as a new perspective on the history of public knowledge. Can you explain what you mean when you say virtues, and what is new about this perspective?
Yeah, I think that most of our listeners know the concept of virtue from the field of moral philosophy. Since Aristotle's virtue ethics are, let's say, the core of philosophical debates about how to be a good person, in a sense, or how to make a person know what is a good thing to do, in a sense, in various situations. And the forms of usage and, more importantly, political applications of this theory were very different and have changed dramatically throughout this history. But I think that we can still recognize certain patterns in the discourses of virtues and can say that virtue is usually understood as a kind of good, positive or character trait that has to be cultivated and is supposed to be cultivated and is meant to make a person good in terms of corresponding normative system. Of course, these normative systems have changed throughout history, and that is basically the point about a very problematic point in virtue ethics. But the interesting, another interesting paradox is that this logic implies a kind of combination of very paternalistic view of just programming people to be good, in a sense, yeah, and the idea that at the end they became autonomous, independent, if they have learned this virtue and acting in accordance with virtue, they can be independent. We can just let them do their things, and they will act rightly in various situations without direct instructions. And beside this field of ethics, the concept of virtue was actively used, for example, by the history of ideas or intellectual history, the history of political thought, and not only in terms of civic virtues, something that is also a very familiar concept, but also epistemic virtues or intellectual virtues versus intellectual vices. All this made historians to switch their focus from the ideas themselves to their social, political, and also scholarly conventions that just made a production of certain kind of ideas, a certain kind of knowledge possible. And that is a very important turn. And that is the sense in which this concept was adopted by the history of science. And probably one most prominent example of scientific virtue is objectivity. And historians have shown that at a certain historical point, to be objective started to mean to be a good scholar or to be a good scientist. It is also a relatively new development, which is not that wasn't had not been so obvious before. But of course, this concept has also its problems in the usage in concrete historical research, because as historians, we can deal with the discourses of virtue. We can analyze the practices of cultivation, this virtue, but it is still clear that, the manifestations of this virtue can be very different, and just people claiming to be objective don't do the same things or don't say the same things, even though they believe acting in accordance with the virtue of objectivity. And I think that it is not a problem, but a very interesting challenge for historical research, especially if we're trying to cross the border between this very narrow field of intellectual work or just forms of cognition and so on, and real political practice. And that is basically the background of my idea to apply this concept to the analyzing of the spread of the Soviet influence in the Central and Eastern Europe after the Second World War. Because it is clear that the Soviet science was conducted, or something like Soviet science with quotation marks. Of course, it is also a very complex phenomenon, which had to be discussed separately. But it claimed to be based on very specific socialist virtues, like partisanship, the loyalty of the concept to the interests of the working class, and so on, and various other progressiveness and various other virtues, and was meant to radically oppose the so-called bourgeois science. And the process of the establishment of the influence of this kind of regime in the cultures which were not confronted, or at least were not had not been under the direct influence of this regime, provides a very interesting, partly of course very tragical, but for historian very interesting material for analyzing this kind of clash of virtues and attempts to universalize this. And that is basically the point at which my approach differs from the established very rich and very, very good historiography of the so-called Sovietization of Central and Eastern Europe in general, and of Poland in particular. Because if you look, usually the most usual way of writing this history is to look, for example, at the spread of Marxism and Leninism, of the ideas and adaption of these ideas to various contexts. Or another very popular approach is to look at the reconstruction of institutions, of scientific and academic institutions, in accordance with the Soviet example. But I propose to look not at these aspects, but at to ask the question, what kind of virtues were supposed to cultivate and to change the foundations of academic, not only the form, not only the ideas to which people were referring, but also the foundations of scientific and academic practice or scholarly practice in Poland. Another question in this connection is if this project was that successful, as it seems from the perspective of just, I don't know, filling the political newspapers or academic journals with references to Marx, Lenin, and Stalin or Engels and so on. If it was that success or a successful restructuring of the academic institutions, if it was that successful as it seems to be, and I think that it's just a kind of For me, virtue is a kind of lens which helps us to look at this process from a different perspective. And just thanks to this different perspective, to take another account of this project, to get a very nuanced picture of very complex processes and contradictions that were connected with this project, their integral part of this project.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So this book, you cover a very specific time in the history of Poland after World War II. And some of our readers, some of our listeners will have some understanding, but others won't. Can you give our listeners just a brief background on Poland leading up to and during the war? And how did we get to the political and intellectual situation that you cover in your book?
Yes, I would like to tell you a nice story, but of course the backgrounds and the prehistory of this, of the process and of the discourses that were covered by the book are very tragical. And you know that Nazi Germany started the Second World War by attacking the Polish Republic. And in a couple of weeks, a considerable part of the Polish state were occupied and parts of the Polish territories were included into the Third Reich and in other territories. Nazi Germany established a very violent, repressive occupation administration. But at the same time, in accordance with a secret agreement between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, another part of the Polish Republic was occupied by the Soviet Union and included into the Socialist Republic of Ukraine. The political leadership of the country was forced to leave and just immigrated to London and established their government in exile. But the protagonists of my book faced a very difficult choice on which side they would stay and try to survive this horrible war. And for some people, especially of you, Jewish region, it was a life-saving to leave to the Soviet side and to go further with the Soviet troops. And for some socialists as well, or communists. But it wasn't that easy, of course, because for the Soviets, security services and for the Soviet regime or Stalinist regime at this point, Poles and the Polish people in general were potential enemies or potential spies, and that repression against Poles was in some cases a preventive, so to say, measure. Only the case of execution of dozens of thousands of Polish officers and soldiers captured by the Soviet Union was just a horrible illustration of this fact. Even socialists and communists weren't safe in the Soviet Union. Some of them were sent to concentration camps or executed and just continued their activity in under very horrible situations. That is a framework. And after the Nazi Germany discovered these graves of this Polish officers and tried to make a propaganda show of it and to split the anti-German coalition, the Soviet Union, Stalin decided to break the relationships with the government in exile in Poland and to create its own political body for the future Polish state. And many of the intellectuals who are playing a central role in my book were just taken from concentration camps, for example, to serve to this new Soviet Polish projects, and they came back to Poland with a Red Army, with the Soviet troops, just because they were very, very useful for Stalin for implementing this post-war Poland, post-war project, his post-war project for post-war Poland. At the same time, there were very structured underground movement and resistance in the territory of Poland, which had a connection to the government in exile and the home army that was struggling against Nazi occupation, and also considered the Soviet troops and their government and the intellectual that came with the Red Army as a new occupation, in fact. That is this horrible background. And the post-war Poland and the starting point of my book is a country which was destroyed by the war, horribly destroyed. That was a meeting point of people of very different experiences of the war. Some of them spent it in immigration in the United States and came back in London. Some of them survived Nazi occupation and helped, for example, Nazi Germany to execute Jews. Other Poles helped Jews to save their lives against these repressive measures. There were Jews who survived concentration camps and so on. That is a very complex and very tragical story. And also Stalin understood that he had to look for a kind of compromise for establishing a regime which would be loyal to him in these territories, because it's just the history of these Polish-Soviet relations created very worse soil for kind of Sovietization of these territories, and very strong role of the Catholic Church, for example, a very, very important role. That is also a very important point, that Stalin and also the Polish communists, the Polish socialists and the intellectuals who were coming to the Soviet army were ready, avoided to use some specific communist slogans. They tried to create in their propaganda very broad idea of some fair social reforms, of the idea not to repress the Catholic Church, the idea just to create a very fair state, which would be based on this kind of social equality, but not in the communist sense, with private property and so on. Another interesting point is that this picture of destroyed Warsaw or Poland by the war was very contrasted by the scholarly debates that were led also under the conditions of occupation by the scholars. And it is really very interesting to read. There is a considerable research on this topic, to read these scholarly debates that continued under the conditions of occupation and continued in accordance with the established norms, conventions, and virtues that were typical for Polish or common for Polish academia in the interwar period. I think that is a point, this constellation of very contradictory factors, the idea of losing a kind of compromise for Poland, and a very strong continuity. That's three points that probably are center for understanding this context of the story that I try to tell the reader in this book.
So thank you. That's a really good overview of the situation that was happening leading up to the war and into the post-war. So coming out of the war then, you make the case in the early post-war period that a specific virtue, the virtue of progressiveness, was supposed to become a foundation of scholarly and academic practice in this new regime. Could you tell us how that worked in practice?
As I have said, the new authorities try to avoid very specific communist slogans and ideological constructions in their official propaganda and their official discourse. And in the field of culture or scholarship and science, the virtue of progressiveness seemed to be much more proper and a good basis for the new, so to say, moral economy of science and scholarship and the new Polish state, much better than very specific communist virtues like partisanship or the loyalty to their working class and the loyalty to the Soviet Union as the avant-garde of the working class and so on. In this case, it is that scholars, also writers for example, artists in a sense, but first of all, scholars and scientists were asked to be progressive and just to liberate themselves and their theories from various reactionary elements, whatever it means. And the fact that a very strict control over various manifestations of this kind of virtue wasn't established yet. And this kind of looking for a compromise, especially in the early post-war years before radical phase of a stage of Stalinization of Poland, it was very important to bring together as many scholars and scientists as possible. The interesting thing about it that when trying to be progressive and to show their participating in this quest from progressiveness, scholars and scientists, without a certain control over the expression of this virtue, formulated some ideas and theories which stood in radical contradiction to the usage of this virtue or the practices of this virtue, for example, in the Soviet Union. One of much more telling examples is, for example, discussions about Marxism in the early post-war years in Poland. And that is very interesting that Marxists were openly accused of being non-progressive or just destroying through the structure, pseudo-religious structure of their ideology and their approaches to science and scholarship. They were accused of promoting a very reactionary ideology in a sense. And the parts of the participants in this debate were very different. For example, of course, for Catholic intellectuals, it was very important argument for destroying, so to say, or struggling against their ambitions of Marxists to accuse Catholics of non-scientific way of thinking, for example. Progressiveness, and it was a very important function of it in the early post-war years, created a space for Catholic scholars and writers to participate in the scholarly and public debates of the early post-war years. And of course, the accusing of Marxists of non-progressive way of doing science or understanding the world, prophetic view of the social process and social development, for example, was a very important argument for Catholics who were trying to be just to save their position in the public life of the post-war Poland. At the same time, there were sociologists that didn't sympathize with the church at all or the Catholicism at all. On the contrary, they were trying to use this quest of for progressivity for creating a kind of regime in which an open development without the respect to some authority figures would be possible. And in this case, the attack of on Marxism from this side was also part of not only of this religious criticism of Marxism, but also a kind of scientific criticism of Marx and comparison it with reference to some sociological theories, accusing it of promotion of kind of religious, pseudo-religious knowledge. And I think that in this case, on the one hand, the perspective on the promotion of the virtue progressiveness explain us something about this project that was implemented in the early post-war years and shows us that the organizers and the activists of this project try to create a very broad basis for something that we call moral economy of the new regime. But at the same time, we can see that the manifestations of this virtue contradicted our idea of kind of Sovietization of kind of Soviet form of a practice in science, scholarship, and also politics, in a sense.
You argue in the book that in these early post-war years that we're talking about, that Poland was defining itself intellectually between the Soviet Union on one side and France on the other. Could you explain a little bit more about that? What is the Soviet Union's position here? How does France become involved? And what is going on with the opposition between these two, like, sort of main ideas intellectually or sources of ideas?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, it wasn't so that Poland defined it, itself, but it, the French culture played a very important role in the interwar period and in Polish intellectual culture and scholarly culture, in the influence their ideas of how to be a good scholar or an engaged scholar and scientist in the interwar period. The case of the Soviet Union is a very different one, and I will start with that. Of course, this kind of friendship with the Soviet Union following the Second World War was a forced friendship. The relationship between the Polish Republic and the Soviet Union, or Bolshevik Russia, let's say, had also their history. We can go into the 19th century and or 18th century and 19th century and talk about the partitions of Poland and the fact that a considerable part of Polish territories just became part of Russian Empire, about the violent suppression of Polish uprisings against the Russian dominance and again the Russian imperial authorities. But it was one of very important ideas of the Bolsheviks to give a kind of liberty to the countries within the Russian empire to make them free from this Russian imperialism. And the independence of Poland, it was an idea that was actively used by the propaganda that the Bolshevik Revolution brought the freedom for the Polish Republic and made it possible to create an independent Polish state. Of course, it's a different story, but also this Bolshevik period of or Soviet period of Russian history was full of very violent conflicts with the Polish state. First of all, we have to remember that many of the active participants in these debates were participants in the Polish-Bolshevik War 1921. The Bolshevik regime decided that for the spread of revolution, then the framework of this quest for a world revolution, one can just help to liberate their working class in Poland and to struggle against this kind of proto-fascist or imperialist regime in Poland. But for the Polish side, of course, it was a very important patriotic duty for many of scholars to participate in the war and to defend them against Bolshevik invasions. And Bolshevik failed them. They didn't win the war. And by the way, Stalin was one of their unfortunate commanders in the Soviet side. That is also a very important point in this story. After that, I have already mentioned the fact that the eastern borders or the eastern territories of the Polish Republic were occupied and annexed by the Soviet Union. There are stories about the execution of Polish officers and dozens of thousands of Polish people were circulating, of course, in the Polish society. All this didn't make, so to say, Poland a very good friend, or they didn't create a good soil for making this kind of friendship with the Soviet Union. But even if we take into account this very strong political pressure and their loyalty to the Soviet Union as a kind of precondition of the existence of the state after the Second World War, we can see that the main discourses on the Soviet Union always repeatedly emphasized that a kind of experience and forms of, in our case, forms of virtuous behavior, for example, or forms of norms and conventions of Soviet science and scholarship were not applicable, couldn't be brought to Poland, couldn't be adopted in Poland, because it's, of course, the Soviet Union is great, it's a great experiment, very interesting, and so on, but it is something that cannot be adapted in Polish soil, just didn't suit it. And the fact that this idea was promoted openly and was supported by many by many scholars publicly is very important illustration of their very specific character of this early post-war years on kind of moral economy of this scholarship in this time. Another interesting point is that, for example, the reflections on Soviet and Russian culture or Russian scholarship or Soviet scholarship were very different from the picture of the self-representation of the Soviet or Stalinist regime. For example, Polish philologists translated the poetry of some poets that were repressed in the Soviet Union and just were persons whose verses couldn't be read and published in the Soviet Union. For example, their reviews of Soviet scholarship applied also references to the people who immigrated from the Soviet Union and continued their developing their theories in, for example, the United States or America, for example. Reflections on formalism was a good example of it. In this case, it was important for me to show that in the early post-war years, the Soviet Union wasn't an example of virtuous behavior, on a kind of set of virtue that could be adapted to Polish case. Unlike this, the French example, it is very interesting that those who were promoting a left-wing program in the virtue of progressiveness, the development of scholarship in accordance and a kind of struggle against obscurantism or kinds of reactionary tendencies, they were referring, first of all, on the example of French intellectuals, French scholars. It is very interesting that even the works or texts about, for example, Lenin or Marx, or the classics of Marx and Leninism, were usually translated from French and were written by the French intellectuals. And the references to French tradition of political engagement is a kind of example of good behavior for scholars who were situated in Poland was also a very important part of this discourse. Another interesting point is, of course, that like progressiveness, which created a kind of space also for the Catholic participation in this story, the French example, and first of all the references to the French personalism, were a kind of example of a progressive Catholicism which could be accepted in Poland under the new conditions. It was a very complex story, of course, because not all Catholics wanted to accept this kind of political and Marxist form of French personalism that was based on the idea of cooperation with Marxism and with communism. First of all, like the journal L'Esprit and Mounier and all these intellectuals gathered around these journals was a very important reference point for these discussions. But it was very important that the authority of the French culture and the French form of progressiveness was a kind of common platform both for socialists, Marxists, and Catholics, which was also a very important characteristic trait of this early post-war period.
It's really fascinating. So I want to take us back to the concept of these virtues and how the concept of virtues started to change during the wave of what you called so-called Stalinization. So can you explain that? What was the shift at that point?
Mm-hmm. That is basically one of the central points of the book and of the story, in my view, because the escalation of the Cold War and many factors that just influenced this changes led, of course, to the changes in the regime and the increase in the pressure of the Soviet Union on other countries from their this era of their dominance. But at the same time, this project was a kind of project of reconstruction, first of all, of their opportunities to publicly express ideas. And of course, logically, the reformation of the censorship was first thing that the organizers and the activists of Stalinization conducted within the framework of this project. There, of course, all these discussions and all these forms of expression of kind of progressiveness that we know from this, from the early post-war years, weren't possible under the conditions of the Stalinization. big congresses and conventions were organized to claim loyalty to the Soviet Union, to the working class. It was a time of the attempts to force scholars and scientists not only to be progressive, but also to connect this kind of progressiveness with the loyalty to the idea of the working class and to the Soviet Union, first of all, as a kind of avant-garde of the working class, also to be a partisan in doing science. There were young Marxist intellectuals that were trained to just to lead this kind of education or re-education of Polish scholars and scientists. The institutes, the research institutes, some of them were closed, some of them were reformed, and they're reorganized on, in accordance with this Soviet example. And in this case, this very general picture seems like a great triumph of this kind of Stalinization. But if we look at a real praxis and a real discussions that probably not always could be published and couldn't make public, but just were led within these congresses and just were reflected in historical sources, we can see that the attempts to create this new kind of moral economy based on this very specific virtues promoted in the Soviet Union, or just routinized them and made to the core of the idea of the good progressive, good academic and scientific practice, didn't succeed in Poland just because a kind of precondition of this success was that at least the majority of scholars and scientists would accept, possibly accept, for example, the authority of these new regimes to conduct something that was called self-criticism, public self-criticism of their reaction or views, and just to join this new partisan science and scholarship. But it wasn't the case in Poland. Some leading scholars publicly called this kind of changes that were required time-serving, and publicly claimed that they didn't want to change the foundations of their academic practice in accordance with the principle that they didn't consider correct or just effective or progressive. The materials of this discussion are very interesting and much more complex than this kind of stereotypical view of this period in Polish history and the history of the Central and Eastern Europe. Another very important point was that even the kind of attempts to create to force the old and established professors to conduct self-criticism or to just to follow the prescribed forms of good academic practice didn't work out. And I think that this failure, this kind of fiasco that was understood also by those who were trying to conduct and to implement this project, was a very important point for this part of story and for the consequences of this.
And so That brings us up to sort of near the end of the time period the book is covers. So what happened in 1956? Why is that year so important?
I think that most of our listeners are familiar with the concept of de-Stalinization and with the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the so-called secret speech delivered by Nikita Khrushchev, who criticized the cult of personality created by Stalin and criticized repressions, by the way, only against the party members. But of course, we understand that, the phenomenon of 1956 is much broader than just one event or the reflection of this event in other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And one of the points that I'm making in my book is that this project that started before the calendar year of 1956 and before this wave of de-Stalinization, of this official de-Stalinization, was that all scholars and scientists could see the failure and the fiasco, in fact, of this project. The phenomenon of 1956 in Poland was very big and very complex and very controversial in a sense. But I would like to focus on one example which could help to illustrate my central point. I think that one of the most important things is that those young Marxist intellectuals, scholars, and scientists who were supposed to become this avant-garde of Stalinization, the teachers of this new virtues and the kind of organizers of this re-education of the whole academia, became the leading oppositional force during the crisis of 1956. The communist youth journals started to critically deal with the reality of the Polish state and then the framework of the quest for something that we can just call honesty, the virtue of honesty. They just wanted to see a correspondence between the ideology of the claims of a socialist regime and their reality, their real life of the workers and of all the people in Poland. And this increasing contradiction between the ideological framework and the claims of the socialist regime and its real praxis forced them to become a driving force of this campaign against the Stalinist virtues, of these very specific virtues that were promoted during the period of Stalinization. It's very important that they still call themselves Marxists, and they wanted to be good Marxists and good Marxist scholars and scientists. They wanted to be progressive and so on, but they claimed that the very idea of the loyalty to a state, for example, or to the Soviet Union as a period of a very harsh criticism and public criticism of the Soviet Union was a kind of, again, we know this argument from the early post-modernists, a kind of religious form of exploding people. It was something that was claimed openly by the Marxist scholars and scientists. And I think that it's a very good illustration of, on the one hand, of the fiasco of this project of Sovietization, but at the same time, an increasing role of national virtues, an idea of protecting themselves against the foreign elements. It played also very, not just to, I didn't want just to give a very idealistic idea of it. It also had a very important effect on making their specific virtues connected with their socialism a kind of foreign element, something that didn't belong to Poland or Polish national virtues. It was a very complex story, but it was the beginning of this unification of very or just coalition of very different forces, also Catholic intellectuals, for example, and Marxists and all this, based on this anti-Soviet sentiment and on this criticism of their virtues that were promoted during the active phase of Stalinism.
Fascinating. As we're getting to the end of our time, what I'd love to hear from you is for our listeners, and I encourage everyone to go and buy the book and read the book, but can you summarize for us what is the most important thing that you want our listeners to take away from your book?
I think two points. The first one, I would like to emphasize that I didn't want just to write a very heroic story of resistance or intellectual resistance to Sovietization. Resistance was very important, but I think that very important thing is to understand that the struggle against this kind of forced attempts to forcibly promote this kind of socialist virtues led to the creation of alternative moral economies or alternative set of virtues or virtuous systems and so on that in fact potentially can also have very authoritarian tendencies. And I think that it had also a very important effect in today's discussions on the questions, for example, of the political dimensions of scientific and scholarly knowledge, of the idea of engagement of scholars and scientists with a political reality, which is in some countries which were just traumatized by this forcible, forced education or re-education is connected with this authoritarian and totalitarian, in a sense, idea of spread a kind of communist communism and forcible reconstruction of the society, repression, and so on. And I think that it's very important to be also critical of the structures and kinds of moral economy that appears as part of this resistance and to critically reflect on that. And the second point, I think that it was important to me to make this book interesting also for those who are not interested in the methodological framework that determined my methodological approach, so to say. I think that is a story about people, and I tried to sort of say to show the very complex and very complex picture of the scholarly and political and public life of Poland in this period. And I think that one can find in this book some things that are not that trivial and might be interesting also for those who are not very interested in reflecting on virtues and all this mythological stuff.
Great. Thank you for that. And finally, before we let you go, our listeners are readers. And so I would love to hear what you recommend as a book for our listeners to pick up?
Yes, of course, it's always a very difficult thing to recommend one book. But I can say that there is a new book that discusses some similar issues, but in a very different way, written by Kirill Kunakhovich, Communism's Public Sphere, Cultures, Politics, and Cold War Poland and Eastern Germany. And I think that is a good reading. The book was published just, I think, that in the same year like mine, or a bit earlier, several months earlier than mine. But I think that's a very interesting book. It's a very different perspective and on very different issues. But I think that is worth reading.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I think we'll leave it for there. We'll leave it there for now. Alexei Lakhmatov, it has been a pleasure discussing your book, Public Knowledge in Cold War Poland, Scholarly Battles and the Clash of Virtues, 1945 to 1956. Thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.